From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, February 17, 2009. GM and Chrysler hand over their plans for survival to the Obama administration. We'll hear how immigrant prisoners are helping each other fight deportation proceedings. And we'll hear about the difficulties Gaza's hospitals are facing as a result of Israel's attack. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A United Nations-backed court began proceedings in Cambodia today. A man known as Comrade Doik stands accused of running a notorious prison during the country's brutal Khmer Rouge regime some 30 years ago. Doik came clean to journalists about some of the horrors he committed during his role as commander at the S-21 prison, from which some 14,000 prisoners were eventually led to Cambodia's killing fields. Doik is the first of five defendants to face charges. All belong to the regime that turned Cambodia into a vast slave labor camp, where at least 1.7 million, some estimates say as many as 2 million, people died of starvation, disease, and execution. The issue before the court today was whether to add 38-year-old Norn Chung Phal, a rare child survivor, to the list of civil parties to the case. Phal missed a filing deadline by just 2 days. In Germany, a court martial began today in the case of a U.S. soldier accused of involvement in the murder of four Iraqi prisoners in 2007. 26-year-old Sergeant Michael Leahy Jr. from Illinois is one of seven charged in the murders and could face dishonorable discharge and life in prison. Cinnamon Nepard has more from Berlin.
The four Iraqis were apparently involved in a shootout with the seven soldiers' battalion. Witnesses say the Iraqi prisoners were taken back to the U.S. operating base for processing, but due to a lack of evidence of their involvement in the attack, they were released shortly afterwards. Later that night, the soldiers allegedly took the four Iraqis to a remote location, bound them, shot them in the head, and dumped their bodies in a Baghdad canal. Leahy Jr. is charged with murder, conspiracy to commit premeditated murder, and obstruction of justice, and is currently also facing murder charges for a separate incident in January 2007. Two of the other accused soldiers have already pleaded guilty to premeditated murder and have agreed to testify against Leahy Jr. It's expected that the military trial will conclude next week. In Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Two former Border Patrol agents convicted of shooting a drug smuggler and covering it up walked out of prison today. Former President George W. Bush commuted their decade-long sentences shortly before leaving office. Ignacio Ramos and Jose Compián were convicted in 2006 of shooting Osvaldo Aldrete Davila and then trying to cover up their crime. The unarmed man was fleeing across the border near El Paso, Texas. And according to a new United Nations report, 40% more civilians were killed in Afghanistan in 2008 than in the previous year. U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces were responsible for almost 40% of the 2,100 people killed, most by airstrikes. Civilian deaths caused by anti-government fighters were largely caused by suicide blasts and improvised explosives in public areas. Rupert Colville is the spokesperson for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The insurgent forces have also persisted with an intimidation campaign that includes a summary execution of individuals perceived to be associated with or supportive of the government and its allies. Victims have included teachers, students, doctors, health workers, tribal chiefs, civilian government employees, former police and military personnel, and even just laborers involved in public interest construction works. Schools have also been heavily targeted, especially girls' schools. And as a result, thousands of students, especially girls, are being denied their right to education.
Aid workers were also increasingly endangered. 38 were killed and 147 abducted in 2008. The UN report was particularly critical of the danger posed by military bases located near residential areas. Kosovo marked the first anniversary of its declaration of independence today, despite a warning from Serbian President Fatmir Sedju that the nation is challenging its former province's secession. The smallest country in the Balkans seceded from Serbia 9 years after the end of the war between Belgrade's security forces and ethnic Albanians. Serbia, along with ally Russia, are still opposed to independence for Kosovo. The U.S. and other important European allies recognize Kosovar sovereignty. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
President Obama was in Denver today, where he signed the $787 billion economic stimulus legislation into law.
Today does mark the beginning of the end, the beginning of what we need to do to create jobs for Americans scrambling in the wake of layoffs, the beginning of what we need to do to provide relief for families worried that they won't be able to pay next month's bills, the beginning of the first steps to set our economy on a firmer foundation, paving the way to long-term growth and prosperity.
Obama signed the bill at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, a building with hundreds of recently installed solar panels. Some 250 politicians, renewable energy advocates, and industry representatives attended the signing. The final stimulus includes an estimated $78 billion for green initiatives, including clean energy and green transportation. After his trip to Colorado, President Obama heads to Arizona before going to Canada later this week. 20,000 California state workers are getting pink slips today. The state's legislature is still at a stalemate on passing a budget. Lawmakers missed last night's deadline to reach a deal, and backers of a proposal that would close the state's $42 billion budget deficit are frustrated they can't acquire the one Republican vote that would pass it. Republicans say too many tax increases are the reason they don't approve of this budget, and so far Democrats won't budge. While the two sides duke it out in Sacramento, thousands of state workers are getting notices they'll be out of a job as early as July, and the state's public works projects may come to a standstill. Christopher Martinez is the Capitol correspondent for KPFA News. He's at the California Capitol.
Legislative leaders reached an agreement a week ago, and the Democrats are all ready to vote on it. They say it's too late to go back to the drawing board because the state is getting ready to send out, you know, lay off thousands of workers, pull the plug on infrastructure construction programs that are already in progress, something that will cost hundreds of millions of dollars to do. They just want one more vote that they think was promised when the leaders reached the budget agreement. And in the Assembly, they have enough Republican votes to join Democrats in the budget. In the Senate, they need to find one more vote, and there are a couple of people that they're looking at, but they're still talking and trying to round up one more Republican.
So we've seen these marathon sessions at the California legislature. Democrats don't want to go back to the drawing table, as you say, and Republicans don't seem to want to give up one vote. What's next?
That's hard to say. There was, as you mentioned, a marathon session in the state Senate over the weekend. The Senate met again yesterday. Today they went into session at 10 o'clock, and the Republicans went into caucus, so they're scheduled to come back at noon. Democrats say they've brought their toothbrushes and they're ready to stay until this budget passes. And I think it's sort of inevitable that there will be a budget that is largely like the agreement, that will include some hefty cuts to programs, that will include some temporary tax increases. But getting one last Republican to join the Democrats and the two Republicans that have already pledged their votes in the Senate, it's hard to tell when that will happen.
Schwarzenegger threatened to send layoff notifications last Friday. That got extended to today, Tuesday. We're talking about 20,000 pink slips. How are state workers responding to this?
This is something that obviously has the unions up in arms. There are 20,000 pink slips, of which they figure about half of them would end up in actual layoffs. This is on top of other jobs that will be lost from construction contractors whose infrastructure programs would be stopped if there's no budget agreement in the next day or two. The loss of jobs would be probably close to 100,000 by the end of the month if there's no budget agreement. So the stakes are huge in this. It's just a matter of what it takes, what kind of Armageddon does the state need to face to convince people to vote for things they really don't want. Anybody who votes for a budget at this point will be voting for things they don't want, whether it's Democrats voting to cut social service programs and public schools, or Republicans voting for a tax increase, nobody's going to lack the budget as a whole. But it's the point where pretty much everybody agrees something has to be done very, very quickly.
Christopher Martinez is the Capitol correspondent for KPFA News. General Motors and Chrysler are submitting their proposals to stay afloat in the long term in exchange for government support in the short term. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the Obama administration appears more willing to provide support to the ailing industry than the past administration, but tough concessions are still expected.
Today is high stakes for General Motors and Chrysler.
They really need to show the government that they are really on the same page with them in terms of what the government thinks the U.S. automotive industry should look like.
That was Bruce Belzowski, assistant research scientist at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Working in collaboration with the government could mean more monetary assistance. President Obama has made it clear that he wants the U.S. car industry to change. Here he is on January 26th.
We must ensure that the fuel-efficient cars of tomorrow are built right here in the United States of America. Increasing fuel efficiency in our cars and trucks is one of the most important steps that we can take to break our cycle of dependence on foreign oil. It will also help spark the innovation needed to ensure that our auto industry keeps pace with competitors around the world.
Well, they're politically in a better position in that they have an Obama administration that is not antagonistic or oblivious to the importance of having an auto industry in the United States.
Robert Weissman is editor of Multinational Monitor.
Economically, they're in a worse situation because it's now clear how serious and very likely long-standing the economic crisis is. And there's just no way for auto companies to do well in a collapsing economy.
Long-term goals such as a new clean, green fleet are likely to be central to GM and Chrysler's plan. But first, they must weather this storm of tight credit and reduced consumer spending. They are in tough negotiations with the United Auto Workers on concessions, which are expected to last beyond Tuesday's deadline. In December, the government gave GM $13 billion and Chrysler $4 billion to last a few months. Greg Martin, spokesperson for GM, says that money helped them to survive.
Getting the company at the right size, you know, giving people a soft landing to trim jobs, trim plants, sell company planes.
On Monday, Obama created a structure signaling close cooperation with the auto industry. He set up a committee to be run by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and economics advisor Larry Summers to oversee the program. Professor Bruce Belzowski says Obama has shown that GM and Chrysler must show real progress, not wishful thinking.
Heavily laden with people who are looking at the numbers and saying, Are the stories that the companies are telling us, do they actually make sense? Can we believe that what they're telling us is actually going to make them viable? And from a financial standpoint, they're really going to have people there who are going to hold their feet to the fire, I think, in that respect.
Ford does not have to work as closely with the government. The company's financial situation is far less serious than Chrysler and GM's. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wraps up the first leg of her inaugural trip overseas. Clinton met with Japanese leaders today on a tour that will also take her to Indonesia, South Korea, and China. But as FSRN's Jason Strother reports from Tokyo, her stop in Japan was as much symbolic as it was substantive.
Many Japanese felt snubbed when former President Bill Clinton skipped over their nation during his tour to Asia in 1998. But on Hillary Clinton's first trip abroad as Secretary of State, she assured Tokyo that the Obama administration still sees Japan as one of the U.S.'s closest allies.
America's relationships across the Pacific are indispensable to addressing the challenges and seizing the opportunities of the 21st century.
The Japan-U.S. alliance may be even more critical now since both nations have been badly hit by the global economic crisis. Tokyo announced this week that its exports-driven economy has had its worst slump in over 30 years. Some here worry that Washington will overlook Japan in favor of improving ties with China during these tough times. But Jeff Kingston, who teaches Japanese studies at Temple University in Tokyo, says that the U.S. will not favor one nation over the other.
We now live in a multilateral world. Global problems require global solutions. That means much more cooperation. And so she is saying we're not going to treat China as an enemy, as a rival. They are a partner. And she, I believe, also is trying to convince the Japanese of the value of working with China as a partner.
Also on Secretary Clinton's agenda was signing an agreement on reducing the number of American soldiers stationed on the Japanese island of Okinawa. The U.S. military has had a presence there since the end of the Second World War. Washington also wants Tokyo to commit troops to the war in Afghanistan, something that many Japanese politicians and the public are weary about. Clinton's visit to the region comes as North Korea may be preparing to test fire a long-range missile. The Secretary of State called on Pyongyang to refrain from raising tensions even higher now that the multinational talks on ending the Kim Jong-il regime's nuclear weapons program are in a deadlock. In a showing of solidarity, Clinton met with family members of Japanese civilians that North Korea admitted to abducting in the 1970s and 80s. Tokyo, for its part, refuses to provide North Korea with promised energy aid until the kidnapping dispute is resolved. Temple University's Jeff Kingston says that Clinton may be trying to nudge Japan back into the negotiations with Pyongyang.
I think she's here to say, look, you know, for us, the main issue is nuclear weapons, and what do we need to do to get Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program? And I think that she is preparing Japan for America seeking a normalized relationship with North Korea and a much wider relationship of economic cooperation, in a sense, to try to bring North Korea into the international community.
Before moving on to Indonesia, Secretary Clinton announced that President Obama has invited Prime Minister Taro Aso to Washington later this month. He'll be the first foreign leader to meet Obama since taking office last month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Tokyo.
Immigrants are the fastest growing segment in the nation's private prison system, but often have the least access to legal counsel. Just days before the end of the Bush administration, then Attorney General Michael Mukasey placed strict limits on immigrants' legal rights and ruled that those facing deportation do not have a constitutional right to request a new hearing if their lawyer was incompetent or fraudulent. With few legal options, immigrant prisoners must turn to fellow prisoners for help with their cases. Julia Paul reports how these jailhouse lawyers can be a lifeline for those fighting deportation.
It could be your father, your mother, your brother, or your sister. Thousands of immigrants who are productive members of society find themselves trapped in a complex deportation system. They are locked up and shipped out, permanently exiled from their family in the United States. But a growing number of detainees, like Prince Brown, are fighting back.
First, I was bamboozled to come to a place I didn't know nothing about. I was tricked into signing papers that would lead to my deportation process starting.
Prince Brown spent nearly 5 years bouncing around immigrant detention facilities from New Jersey to Louisiana. He says he received poor legal advice.
I was also tricked by lawyers who I didn't was illiterate to the immigration process, and I ended up having to do my own paperwork and waste my money paying for a lawyer that didn't do nothing for me.
Immigration law is extremely complicated, but unlike people with criminal charges, those facing civil immigration charges do not have a right to a court-appointed attorney. Many immigrant detainees often turn to other prisoners who help them represent themselves. The legal term for self-representation is pro se.
Pro se means self. You do things by yourself.
Pro se litigants often come up with cutting-edge arguments since they're not merely fighting a case, but they're fighting to stay with their families. Benita Jain is an attorney with Immigrant Defense Project.
Jailhouse lawyers are the folks that are in the law libraries all day. They pour through books, they pour through cases, they write to every legal and human rights organization and immigrant rights organization that they can think of to get materials that they need to fight their cases.
But even if an immigrant makes it to court, those who represent themselves are outsiders to the system.
There's sort of an in culture with the lawyers and the judges because they're all lawyers.
Maria Muentes is a community organizer with Families for Freedom.
They're all attorneys. The judges are attorneys mostly. The attorneys are obviously attorneys. They know each other. And a lot of times I feel like, and I know other people have said this too, you know, their relationship is to each other. Maybe your argument is completely valid and it's not going to be treated the same way as the same argument if it's made by an attorney.
Despite these challenges, more and more immigrants, like Prince Brong, are learning about the law out of sheer need.
It was real uplifting, and it showed that you're not by yourself. People do care, because sometimes when you're in those faraway states, we're far away from home, you just feel like nobody give a about you, understand what I'm saying? And sometimes you just feel down and depressed.
Brong eventually won his case, and he is now once again a legal permanent resident. He now serves on the board of Families for Freedom.
I just try to like show people coming in that it can happen. It's not impossible. We just need to stick together and just have hope.
Towards the end of his case, Prince Brong had help from Benita Jain and other lawyers. Benita continues to provide resources to people fighting their own cases.
I think in institutions, it can also be a powerful organizing tool because people are able to then spread that knowledge out to everyone else. So, you know, more people will know what their rights are and how to challenge this steamroller process that deportation often ends up being.
In collaboration with Ravi Ragbir and Janice Roosevelt at the Community News Production Institute, I'm Julie Paul for FSRN.
And we want to mention that our reporter, Julia Paul, is a member of Families for Freedom, a group featured in this story. One of the many repercussions some survivors of Israel's recent attack on the Gaza Strip are left to deal with is disabilities. In the first of a two-part series on Gaza's overburdened medical system, Rami Al-Maghari reports that hospitals there are struggling with the task of caring for Palestinian men, women, and children who were left disabled as a result of the war.
It was mid-January, at the height of the Israeli military's attacks on Gaza. 47-year-old Suher Zimmo was at home alone when something crashed into her bedroom. Suher is being treated at the Al-Shifa Hospital here in Gaza after doctors amputated her right leg. She now uses a wheelchair to move around.
I was injured inside my home when the Israelis attacked Tal el-Awa. I think it was a warplane's rocket that landed in my bedroom. As you see, my leg had to be amputated and my other leg was hurt as well. At that time, there were no ambulances, so my husband had to take me to the hospital himself.
Suher is not alone. Yahya Abu Saif, a 20-year-old man from the northern Jabalia town, was at a local mosque when he was caught up in an Israeli bombing. The bombing caused injuries so severe that doctors had to amputate Yahya's leg. He is now being rehabilitated at the Al-Wafa Hospital, Gaza's sole rehabilitation center.
I was praying the evening prayer at the Ibrahim al-Maqdam Mosque. Then I left the mosque when an Israeli missile hit us.
The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza estimates that at least 100 Palestinian men, women and children had limbs amputated because of injuries during the three-week-long attacks on Gaza. Dr. Fawzia Nabulsiya is a chief of the ICU of Al-Shifa Hospital.
Many of these kinds of cases we have never seen before. We're seeing amputated limbs, especially lower limbs, spinal cord injuries, and cases of deep trauma. The ICU has received 283 cases, and that's how many cases we would usually receive in a period of 6 or 7 months.
Many of these wounded were sent to hospitals outside of Gaza, either for treatment a rehabilitation. Additionally, the main Gaza-based rehabilitation center was damaged during the attacks. Nesman is a spokesperson for the health ministry in Gaza.
The Ministry of Health does not have institutions that carry out rehabilitation. Therefore, the ministry buys the services from other institutions. Actually, many Arab or Islamic countries extended a hand of assistance. For example, a Turkish institution called IHH has opened a branch in Gaza City, preparing to provide prosthetics.
Currently, the Al-Wafa Hospital is the only place in Gaza that can treat amputees. Dr. Maher Shamia is the clinical principal of the hospital.
We are prepared to receive all cases that have completed treatment at the health ministry's hospitals or at hospitals abroad. The rehabilitation we carry out is physical, psychological, and clinical. In addition, we are ready to carry out cosmetic surgeries for limbs that need prosthetics.
Medical sources say that the number of injuries in Gaza due to the recent Israeli attacks on the coastal enclave has risen to 6,000, and the death toll more than 1,350. Half of them are women and children. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
In celebration of African Heritage Month, for profiles in excellence, we honor Black women of the pen broke out in the late 20th century, writing fiction that exposed sexism, domestic violence, and women's oppression. They sold millions of copies and won hundreds of awards. But more importantly, they expanded the palette of Black literature by telling women's stories. Women like Toni Cade Bambara, Rita Dove, Audre Lorde, Toni Morrison, Gloria Naylor, Nsazake Shange, and Alice Walker transformed Black writing and became rivers feeding oceans worldwide. Walker's work has transcended fiction to enter academic gender studies as in usage of the term womanist to denote Black women's experiences as distinct from feminist. Toni Morrison has won virtually every writing award there is, especially for her 1987 masterpiece, Beloved, a complex yet beautifully wrought work which draws directly from some of the grimmest days of Black history, slavery. By writing fiction, Black women are rewriting history. For Hard Knock Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And make sure you tune back in tomorrow when we hear another story from the ground in Gaza, where doctors are struggling to save lives with outdated equipment and dwindling medication. That's Wednesday on FSRN. And that wraps up today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by emailing us at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. And our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.